people recognise now. It's become an election issue. It's something that there has to be movement on because people are so angry about the treatment of our oceans and the fact that we're being put at risk like this.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, and I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you. Your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. On today's episode, I'm joined by Daisy Brickhill of Oceana UK, a subsidiary of Oceana, the world's largest ocean conservation organisation. Throughout her career, Daisy has been at the forefront of communication strategies aimed at catalyzing change for the betterment of our planet. From advocating for transparency in the fishing industry or championing the conservation of blue carbon habitats, Daisy's work at organizations like the Environmental Justice Foundation and Oceana have been instrumental in driving crucial environmental initiatives forward. Daisy joined Oceana in the UK as head of communications in May of last year, helping the charity expand its campaigns to restore waters in the UK by winning effective science-based policies and management. Since its inception 2 years ago, Oceana UK has been dedicated to conjuring strategic and hard-hitting campaigns to ban bottom trawling, end overfishing, and end new offshore oil and gas drilling. So Daisy, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Tell us about your journey to where you are today.
Thanks, John. So as you mentioned, Oceana is the world's largest international advocacy organisation, which is dedicated solely to ocean conservation. And we've got offices all over the world. We initially started in 2001 by a group of foundations which identified that there was a vanishingly small amount of funding going into protecting the ocean. And since then, Oceana has helped to protect nearly 4 million square miles of ocean. In the UK, where I'm based, it's a fairly new part of the organisation, as you said. And post-Brexit, you know, the UK is continuing to navigate its exit from the EU. We're putting in place new laws, policies are being crafted. So there's really an opportunity there to do really important good work with an incredibly important maritime nation. So we have an office by the sea in Cornwall, and that's where I'm speaking to you from today. So I saw fishing boats in the harbour this morning, swimmers in the sea, and a few weeks ago there was even a humpback whale out in the bay. So that was incredibly exciting. So from that base, we're really connected to those coastal communities and the ocean wildlife that we care about. But we also have a base in the heart of London, and that's within easy reach of Parliament and the corridors of power. And so we're really well placed to drive change from those two bases. And as you mentioned, we've got three main campaigns. So ending bottom trawling in marine protected areas. And honestly, it still blows my mind after many years working in conservation and communications that this incredibly destructive form of fishing is still allowed in what is called a protected area. You know, bottom trawlers drag heavy weighted nets across the seabed. They're effectively bulldozing habitats like ancient corals and kelp forests, you know, that are vital to ocean health. And yet, bottom trawling is permitted in almost all of our marine protected areas. So that's really shocking and something that we're working very hard to end. Alongside catastrophic oil spills, which grab all the headlines, there are smaller routine spillages from these developments that pollute the UK's seas on an almost daily basis. So it's vital to protect our ocean wildlife and to stabilise our climate that we end this ludicrous addiction to fossil fuels. We need a just transition to renewables. And then last but not least is ending overfishing. Over a third of UK fish populations are being overfished, and a quarter have been depleted to critically low population sizes. Stocks could bounce back. What we need is a clear strategy from government which follows the science, sets sustainable catch limits, and we really urgently need it now for the sake of our fishing industry, but also, of course, for the sake of our oceans.
Well, look, you told us a lot there. Just one thing I've really picked up on is the fact that you're allowed to do bottom trawling in a marine protected area. And I think for a lot of people, they'll wonder what a marine protected area is actually protecting. What does it mean then, marine protected area, if that's allowed?
I mean, we wonder that ourselves, John, to be honest. Some of these areas, we really kind of worry that they are just lines on a map. You know, it's just a good news story for the day, and it doesn't have any real meaning.
So what are they meant to do then? When the government says we've created this marine protected area, what are the things that are in there that it's saying that we're doing?
Yeah, so they will be looking at whether there's habitats that are important, or whether there's wildlife in the area that's important. And that's what these areas should be protecting. And the government will say, we're going to put in place various protections for this. We'll consider the different options. We'll analyse what we should be protecting, what needs to be protecting based on the wildlife. And it gets very detailed. But when you really drill down into it, some of these areas really, you know, aren't protected at all. Fishing, you know, industrial scale fishing is allowed. As I said, bottom trawling, which is one of the most destructive forms of fishing, is allowed. You know, so really we're struggling to see how these areas are being protected just as much as you are.
So that was a really good intro to Oceana. Just tell us a bit more about your own background, how you got into communications.
Yeah, so my background is really science, and you know, this podcast is obviously called Communicating Purpose, and I feel that that's something that I've really been kind of focused on throughout my career. So, you know, initially as a kind of, you know, young person who was looking at the environment and thinking this really needs to be, you know, protected, we need to start protecting nature, how can I help? At that point, I felt like science was the right way to go about that. That was where I could help the most. So I studied biology at university, and then I did a PhD in ecology. And I spent a very enjoyable few years chasing starlings around a remote island in the North Sea and looking at their population changes. However, and it, you know, it taught me a lot of different skills, and you know, communication as well as analytics, and you know, I don't regret it at all. But during the time of that PhD, I started to come to realize that there's lots of great science out there already, and I felt like communication was perhaps where I could be more helpful in helping to protect nature. And so at that point, after my PhD, I kind of made a change and went into science communication, and worked with the European Commission for a little while, working with them to help bridge that gap between science and policymakers, so academic science and real applied science on the ground. So that was really good fun, because I was able to kind of roll my sleeves up. I had a doctorate. I wasn't afraid of academic papers. I could roll my sleeves up and get involved and kind of clarify them and show the policymakers what was the really important results. So that was really good fun. And then continued working in science communication for a global change research institute, YASA, which is based in Vienna. And again, trying to bridge that gap between science and policy, what's happening on the ground, how can we translate that kind of very cutting edge science to really useful solutions on the ground. But even in the course of this kind of, you know, work, I was feeling more and more like there's lots of great science out there, and you know, communicating it to policymakers is a really valuable thing. But I also felt like we needed to start advocating for nature. I wanted to start really, you know, making the case in a very strong kind of way, in a way that, you know, very measured, very quiet kind of neutral tone communications as part of a research institute didn't allow me to do. So that's when I moved to the Environmental Justice Foundation and really was able to start, you know, kind of telling emotive stories, telling creative stories, all based on science, and making sure that it was very rigorous and very accurate, but really kind of making the case in different ways for our planet.
Yeah. Well, we need more scientists in communications, and I found that it's where some of the best stories are. We did a couple of years ago, we worked with scientists on the story of plastic is in your blood with our great clients, Common Seas. But I'm always surprised that actually scientists are often not that strong at communicating in a way that generally people understand. But when you look into it, there's often some really, really interesting things in there, but they've gone down a bit of a rabbit hole themselves of using language that, you know, only they're speaking and other peers of theirs are speaking, in overqualifying everything they say so that you don't have a like strong point. So there's lots of opportunities for good communicators in those academic papers, as you say. And also we need more of those kind of fact-based stories in a world where there is a premium on truth. Having the science to back up stories is so valuable.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, that's something that is really very dear to my heart, you know. And it's been a wonderful experience, actually, kind of being involved in a very new office at Oceana UK and being able to kind of think about that, all of that kind of thing, you know, from the very beginning. And something that's very important to us is being bold, you know, able to make those bold statements, call out government agencies or whoever needs to be called out, as well as having it be very robust, very carefully based on science, so that we become, you know, we're able to have both that creative cut through and, you know, a trusted source of accurate insight and evidence-based advice.
What have been some of the biggest challenges that you've faced in communication at Oceana or anywhere else?
Yeah, I think at Oceana, an interesting challenge for us is that the ocean isn't our element. You know, it's not somewhere humans live. So it's obviously harder, you know, for us to go for a stroll in a kelp forest than it is to go for a stroll in a pine forest. So it's our kind of job to find a way for people to relate to issues that are happening far away and out of sight. And, you know, fish, they don't always score highly on the charisma stakes. But they've been misunderstood.
Yeah, and we've had some fantastic ocean-based campaigns, haven't we? And I just think of the European Overcatch campaign that was launched a few years ago. There are ways of capturing people's imagination. And also, it's just, I think British people have a really good sense of injustice. And if they see something is wrong and wasteful, they do get passionate about it. People don't like waste and they don't like injustice. And so...
And that's been, it's been really, you know, good fun exploring that kind of how do we make those connections with people? How do we find a way that for fish to become interesting? Is it kind of injustice and waste? Or, you know, is it the fact that they're, you know, fascinating animals in their own right, that they hold a vital role in ocean ecosystems? But yeah, so and one example of the ways that we've been kind of exploring how to communicate some of these issues is a series of films that we created for social media. So we created them on a kind of basis of their film trailers, essentially, is the concept. So a format that people kind of understand. We worked with a company called Gripping Films. And our first trailer, for instance, was called The Trawl. And that is a kind of disaster movie style trailer. And it shows what it would be like if a human city was bottom trawled. You know, the equivalent, if we were living in the corals, you know, we would be looking up this terrifying thing descending from above us and, you know, kind of raising our community to the ground. So that was a kind of way of bringing that issue to life in a way that people could understand and relate to. We also made an oil and gas film, Rigged, which tells the kind of story of the industrialization of our ocean using from the point of view of a whale. So showing how lives can be torn apart by these developments. You know, those aren't human lives, but you can kind of relate to the journey that wildlife is going on. So yeah, it's been really good fun, and you know, I think we have been getting cut through with that.
Well, it sounds really, really nice doing that. Are there any other mediums that you really like to communicate through?
Yeah, so I think, you know, for our kind of campaign launches, it's always a kind of case of a pincer maneuver where, you know, we're looking at multiple channels, we're coming in at different angles with different, you know, framings. But I would highlight that we've had some really nice success with radio and podcast, actually. I'm extremely lucky to work with amazing speakers in the form of our executive director, Hugo Tagholm, our campaigns director, Alex Elliott. And those kind of, you know, radio and speaking events, it really allows them to share both the kind of urgency of the issues and the awe-inspiring nature of our oceans. I think that's worked really well. I also, some of our work lends itself to investigative journalism a little bit. So that's an area where we like working with journalists to develop those stories in an in-depth kind of way has been a really nice channel for us as well. And I mentioned, of course, creative video content, which gives us point of difference and enables us to get those messages cutting through.
Yeah. And you've got, you know, you mentioned there Hugo Tagholm, who's someone that I've known for a long time as a campaigner, and some people will say, where do I know that name from? He is the person who set up Surfers Against Sewage as a campaigning organisation and moved to Oceania in the last couple of years. But he's someone who has been very good at getting that message across. I think for some people in the UK, Surfers Against Sewage will have been there for one of their first points of contact outside of kind of the bigger NGOs like Greenpeace and WWF of a really clear campaign, when there was that campaign that I think about 2 decades ago, he started talking about the fact that sewage waste was being just pumped out into our ocean down in places like Cornwall, where you're sitting at the moment, Daisy, where surfers were forced to surf, and swimmers as well, exactly where sewage is pumped out. And the stories we have at the moment with Thames Water are showing that despite all the efforts, despite all that highlighting, it's something that is still going on, still needs to have that work there, despite a number of successes that Surfers Against Sewage did have. I don't want to take any of those away from them, because we do have cleaner beaches now in the UK. I think back then in the 80s, it was just every single beach was just, you know, 100 metres away. You could have raw sewage being pumped out where people were swimming. We can't quite as much anymore, but what we're seeing with Thames Water is you've got these instances where all you need is a bit of rainfall and they all wash out into the rivers anyway.
I think what's nice about that campaign, you know, I agree with you that there's obviously still a lot of work to be done, but it's so nice to see it really getting the prominence that it deserves. People recognize now, you know, it's become, you know, an election issue. It's something that there has to be movement on, because people are so angry about the treatment of our oceans and the fact that we're being put at risk like this.
Great. Are there any areas that you think Higginson's strategy should be exploring and looking into?
Interesting question. Just from my point of view, something that I've been interested in exploring has been how AI is going to contribute to our communications, you know, and how we can use that as an interesting tool. You know, I don't in any way want to move away from having the creativity of humans, you know, being downgraded at all. And, you know, I don't want our communications to be run by AI in any way. But I think, you know, there's a lot of scope for them to be a really interesting tool as part of a communications kit. So that's something that I'm really interested in exploring. And so it'd be interesting to know what can be done with that.
Very interesting. Daisy Brickhill, Oceania UK's Head of Communications. You've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose, produced this week by Catherine Kitchen. If you'd like to know more about how Higginson's strategy supports purpose-led organisations, please visit higginsonstrategy.com.